we are holding on Kufiyut. We're holding on Kufiyut Aleph on the Beis, the second line of the wide line. Okay, we started talking yesterday about where exactly we learned that a husband yashins his wife and not the other way around. We had a bias, but after all, the pasuk says that you give his nachlo l'she'ere a part of elov, which on the face of it means to his wife, at least if we explain she'ere to mean the wife. So we said a bias explanation where he moves around words in the pasuk to make it yield that result. Rava says that can't work. You can't cut apart. You can't cut and paste the pasuk like that. So instead, he says gerdin or mosif and bedoshin. That what you do is you move letters, you move prefixes and suffixes from one word to the other. Or as we said yesterday, maybe you don't technically need to move them, but the pasuk can be reinterpreted without having to do that.
But really, it's a stretch.
Yeah, but it's not as much of a stretch as a bias. So now,
no, it's not. But I mean,
but still, okay. But we said yesterday that it's not, because the pasuk can be interpreted without moving anything, and if you want to make it be more grammatical, then you'd have to move things. But it's still it's only moving letters, it's only moving individual letters, prefixes and suffixes, rather than whole words.
Right.
Okay. So the high tana maisel on the hospital. The following tana, rather, namely tana dreid abishmo, as we're gonna have in a second, learns this concept from a different source. The tanya, we learn it a braisa. When the pasuk says v'yorash oisa, the pasuk says that he yashins her. Malamet shabal yorish ishto divrei Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva says it means that the husband yashins his wife. That's basically the same as what we said before. That Abaye and Rava say that we learn it from that one pasuk that v'nasatam es nachlosa v'sheire hakor ve'elam v'mishpachta v'yorash oisa. That from that pasuk we learn either according to Abaye's method or according to Rava's method that the husband yashins his wife.
And before, how did we interpret
it? We said that. Abaya learned it like that. Rava learned it. Rava said that you can't cut and paste the pasuk, so you do gerdin, mosif, and bedoshin. Rabbi Akiva is not really getting into that level of detail over here. He's just saying, from that pasuk, we darshin either according to Abaya or according to Rava, that the husband yarshins his wife. We're not talking, that's not the tana that we're talking about. We're going to say Rabbi Shmuel has a different way of learning it. Rabbi Shmuel says you don't need that. I have a better way. I don't hold of this gerdin or mosif and bedoshin. I don't hold of this moving around words or letters in a pasuk to make a drasha. Rather, I have a different source to learn this concept that a husband yashins his wife. Like this, Harehu Omer, the pasuk says at the end of Parshas Maaseh. Again, at the end of Maaseh, not the end of Maaseh, rather at the end of Parshas Maaseh, the Torah tells us how. Again, this is after the story of Bnei Slochad, after Moshe has given as told them what the Eivishta said, what the dinim of Yerusha are. Shevet Menashe comes with a complaint. What's going to happen? Not a complaint, really, but a question. What's going to happen when Bnei Slochad marry men from other Shevatim? Then the Nachla is going to wind up by that other Shevet. What do we do about it? So Moshe tells them that the Eivishta says that, yes, heiresses like that have to marry within their own Shevet. Now, when you get down to it, if a woman, let's say one of these Bnei Slochad, marries a man from another Shevet, there's two ways in which that nachla can wind up in the hands of another shevet. Either that she dies and her either that she dies without having any children and her husband yashins her, or she dies having had children and her sons yashin her. She has sons and her sons yashin her.
Her sons are from another.
Either way, that's the point. The husband and the sons are from a different shevet. So we're going to be talking over and over in the Gemara about that, and also tomorrow, about, we have, it's called Hasavas HaBa'al and Hasavas HaBen. Hasavas means moving it from one Sheva to another, which is the Lashon of the Pasuk over there. That's the Lashon of the Pasuk is V'lo Sisev Nachlo L'vnei Yisrael Mimata El Mata. V'lo Sisev Nachlo Mimata El Mata Echa. Sisev means it shouldn't turn. It shouldn't be moved around from one Sheva to another. So we're going to be talking throughout the sugya about hasava habal, which means that you have a case
enough,
where because what
isn't that enough?
No, but that we have to understand which one is the pasuk mainly being makbid on. We're going to get to that. But you have hasava habal, namely the fact that as soon as she marries a man from another shevet, that automatically creates that there can be a situation where the nachla winds up going to another shevet, namely if she dies before her husband and her husband yashins her. That's called hasava habal. And then we're going to have Hasava Haben, where if they have a son, then that son, again, belongs to the father's Shevet, not to the mother's, then you're going to have the Nachla is going to go to another Shevet that way.
If it belongs to the mother's?
What do you mean? I mean, if the...
It's always to the father.
It always, the person goes according to their father's Shevet. Mm-hmm. That'd be Mishpachas Oz and Mishpachas Em, yeah. Okay. So what it is like this thing. So Rabbi Shmuel is saying So Rabbi Shmuel is saying that when the pasuk says, any daughter that yarshins an inheritance from the shvatim of Bnei Yisrael, then she has to marry somebody from the family, from the shevet of her father. Meaning, he understands, the pasuk is specifically concerned about the problem that if she marries a man from another shevet, there's going to be hasavas habal, that's going to go to her husband, who is from another shevet as her. Now, the Gemara is going to later ask, why don't we think the pasuk is concerned about hasavas haben? Why don't you think the pasuk is concerned about that which she'll have a son who'll belong to another shevet? We'll get back to that, but for the moment, let's deal with the braisa on its own terms. He says that so what does it mean? If the pasuk is concerned about hasava sabal, that implies the husband yarshins his wife. If the husband didn't yarshin his wife, there'd be nothing to worry about. So there wouldn't be hasava sabal because the nakla wouldn't go to another shevet. The fact that the pasuk is makbid on that implies that the husband yarshins his wife. But then Rabbi Shmuel continues. You have another pasuk that also expresses this because it continues with a few pasukim later. There should not be moved nachla from Bnei Yisrael from one shevet to another. So we have another pasuk. That's the point. That's what the Gemara is going to say. That we see that therefore that the pasuk, even if you were to argue that one pasuk is talking about asava saben, the other one must be talking about asava sabal. So therefore we have a source that it means that the husband yashin. And then we have another pasuk. The last pasuk of Sefer Yoshua says that Elazar ben Aaron mess. Elazar passed away. Vayikberoi, he would give us Pinchas benoy, and they buried him on the hill of his son Pinchas. So you have to ask, what hill of his son Pinchas? The chiminayim of Pinchas shalahari Elazar. How does Pinchas come to have a hill? If it's saying the hill of Pinchas implies it only belonged to Pinchas, he never yarshin it from his father Elazar. How does Pinchas come to have a hill that his father Elazar didn't have? L'chora, if he's going to have power. If the pasuk is calling it the hill of Pinchas, it seems to imply that it's a hill that belonged only to him, not to his father. So where did he get it from? The Rabag says on a pshat level, on the pasuk, you could say, okay, it did belong to Elazar, but as soon as he passed away, Pinchas yarshin it. Therefore, the pasuk calls it, give us Pinchas. The Gemara doesn't like that explanation, because still, it's an unusual way of saying it. It should just say that, you know, they buried him in a giver that belonged to him then. Why if it's give us Pinchas? So how does Pinchas come to have a hill that Elazar didn't own? Ella Malamach and Nasa Pinchas Isha, this teaches us that Pinchas married a wife, Umesa, and then she died, Yarsha, and he yarshin her. Which, by the way, the Ravid says the point is not just the fact that the Gemara is asking how does Pinchas come to have a hill. The pasuk finishes off. The Gemara is not quoting the second half of the pasuk over here, but the second half, the last words of the pasuk are that this hill was the Har Ephraim, on the hill of Ephraim, in the mountains of Ephraim. Now, the Kohenim, Pinchas was a Kohen, Elazar and Pinchas were Kohen. So that's the thing. So what is it? They were given cities. They were given 48 cities. The Kohanim and Levim were given cities in Eretz Yisrael. But the cities that belonged to the Kohanim, the Pesukim say earlier in Sefer Yoshua, all were in the Nachlos of Yehuda and Shimon and Binyamin, the southern part of Eretz Yisrael. They were given to the Kohanim. They had the right to live there. They had the right to bury their nation outside of it. Well, whatever. The point is, you could still say they owned it. But the point of the question is, the Kohanim cities were all in Shevet Yehuda, Shimon, and Binyamin. Not in Ephraim. Ephraim was Bnei Kohath. So how does Pinchas, so even if you're going to say, fine, Pinchas had a place in one of the cities of the Kohanim and Levim, but those are not in Shevet Ephraim.
Why was it in Ephraim?
Because it says Bahar Ephraim. That's, again, the Gemara is not quoting that half of the puzzle. But the does say Bahar Ephraim, yes. The last words say for Yeshua, Bahar Ephraim, yes. So that's part of it. So the question is twofold. How does Pinchas come to have a hill that never belonged to Elazar? And anyway, how does he have a hill at the Bechal in Shevet Ephraim? So the answer is that he married a woman from Shevet Ephraim. She passed away, and he yarshins from her. So we see another source that a husband yarshins his wife.
Right.
And then you have a fourth pasuk that
we don't need.
So far, Rabbi Shmuel is saying that I have many different psukim.
Right.
You know what? Actually, I think I skipped a line over there. Yeah. So you have five psukim altogether: three from Torah and one from Nevi'im and one from Ksurim. So you had Chobas Yereshes Nachla. That was the first one. Ba'asava Sabala Kosam Adaber. But Omer, then you had a pasuk called Sistiv Nachla of Nei Yom Imata Almata. Nachla shouldn't turn from Jewish people from one matter to another. But Omer, and then right after that it says Sistiv Nachla Imata Almata Acher. Again, it repeats that Nachla shouldn't be going around from one shevet to another. So you have three psukim. Va'omer, then you have the one where Elazar ben Aaron, yes, yeah. Va'omer, and that's four. And number five, you have a pasuk from Divrei Yomim. The Gemara is going to deal with soon why he needs five. Okay, but anyway. The Pasuk says in Divrei Yomim, Usguv Hoilet Etz Yair, Sguv Fathered Yair, these are people from Shevet, these are people from Shevet Yehuda, by Hiloi Esrim B'Sholosh Orim Be'eretz HaGilad, and he, Yair, had 23 cities in the land of Gilad. So again, you have to ask, Chiminayim L'Yair Shalahoilet Sguv. How does Yair come to have cities in Gilad when Sguv didn't own him?
And then Gilad was part of which?
Gilad actually belongs to Shevet Menasheh. That's a whole different discussion. How do people from Shevet Yehuda come to be owning territory in Shevet Menasheh anyway? A different proportion talk about that. Different proportion talk about, first of all, is this the same? First of all, is this the same Yair that's mentioned in Dibra Yomim? He's mentioned among the descendants of Yehuda. But the Pesukim actually before that say that Machir, the son of Menasheh, had relations with a woman from Shevet Yehuda. This is before Matan Torah. You were allowed to have relations without Chuppah Kedushin, and they had a son, Sguv, and Sguv had a son, Yair. So in that sense, so on his mother's side, he's from Shevet Yehuda, therefore he's listed among the descendants of Shevet Yehuda over there, but on his father's side, it's from Shevet Menasheh. Mepharshim also deal with the question, is this the same Yair who is mentioned at the end of Parshas Matos, at the end of Parashas Matos, that says that he conquered a bunch of villages in the Gilad and called them Chavos Yair. He called them the villages of Yair. Is that the same Yair as the one in this pasuk over here? By Yair ben Menasheh Holach by Yoked es Chavoseihem, he captured their villages by Yichres and Chavos Yair. He called them Chavos Yair. Is that the same one or not? Some of the Mepharshim say yes, some say no. On top of that, there's a third Yair in Tanakh who also owned cities in Eretz Gilad. He was one of the Shofrim. And pretty much all the Mepharshim say that was definitely a different one, because otherwise he would have lived a very long time. This one, whether it's the same one from Divrei Yomim, it's different Mepharshim. Anyway, okay. So again, how does Yair come to have cities in Gilad, which Sguv, his father, didn't have? Malama Shanasa Yair Isher Meisav Yarsha. Same thing. We learn from that that Yair married a woman from Shevet from Shevet Menasheh, so therefore she owned territory in that area, Umesa, and then she died, Yarsha, and he Yarshin from her.
You don't need all this.
No, well, that's what I was going to say. You're going to say why we need all of them, but yeah. Now, Tosfos asked the question. I mean, if Yair himself is one of the people who came into Eretz Yisrael, why shouldn't we assume, fine, he gets a Nachla in his own right? We're going to have later on in the Perek the question, how exactly was Eretz Yisrael divided? Was it basically according to the people who left Mitzrayim or according to the people who came into Eretz Yisrael? If you say Yair was one of the people who came into Eretz Yisrael, why isn't he entitled to his own portion in his own right, which never belonged to Sguv?
So Tosfos, he was not a lady.
No, he's from Shevet Yehuda, or Menasheh is the case, maybe. So Tosfos leaves it unanswered. Different Mepharshim talk about maybe Yair was born only after they came into Eretz Yisrael, so in that case he doesn't have a Nachla of his own, he has only whatever he inherited from his father, or from his wife, as we're saying over here. Also, again, it gets into the question, how does Yair from Shevet Yehuda come to have something in the territory of Menasheh, etc. Okay, so we have to ask, my Va'omer, what's this Va'omer? Why does Rabbi Shmuel have to bring five different psukim to prove this point? It's like this. Because you might start answering like this. The Sibas, the Savas Haben Kokovid Kra, maybe the first pasuk that we quoted, the Chobas Yereshes Nachla, that any daughter that inherits property in Eretz Yisrael from any Shevet has to marry within her father's Shevet. Maybe, and if not, then it'll move to another Shevet. Maybe the Torah is only concerned about her Savas Haben. Maybe the Torah is only concerned that eventually she's going to have a son. That son is going to belong to another Shevet, and then the Nachla is going to be moved to another Shevet. So maybe you could say, maybe from that pasuk you don't have any proof of the husband actions. The problem is only Hasavas Aben. Toshma, No, never mind, Yair. First we're dealing with the three psukim in the Torah. The three psukim back to back over here. We're doing them out of order, actually, but whatever. Chabas Yoreshet Nachla, pasuk Ches. V'loisitiv Nachla L'vnei Yisrael M'mata O'mata, pasuk Zayin. And V'loisitiv Nachla M'mata O'mata O'achar, pasuk Tes. You have three psukim in a row that basically seem to express the same idea. So and Rabbi Shmuel quoted all of them. So why do we need all three of them? Because if we started with only the pasuk that a daughter who yarshin has to marry somebody from her father's family, you would say, you know why? Not because her husband yarshins from her, because her son eventually yarshins from her, and her son is from another shevet. Therefore, Toshma, that's why he brings the other pasuk. That's why he brings pasuk Zion. V'loisitiv Nachla L'vnei Yisrael M'mata L'mata. That you don't want Nachla to be going from one Shevet to another. In other words, therefore, so Torah is repeating itself, it must be. One is teaching us the problem is the husband might be Arshin, the other is teaching us the problem of the son might be Arshin. Okay. The Chitema Lava all of the Lava. So you might answer, Lav Daska. Maybe they're both talking about Hasava Sabdain. Maybe the Torah is not concerned about the husband Yashining. What because maybe we need a loisa and an ethic. Meaning if you only had the Pasuk, if you only had Pasuk Chet, La'echad mishpachas nate avi atiyah l'isha, that is a mitzvah saseh. So if she doesn't do that, if she marries somebody from another shevet, it's called a lav ha-bamikal eset. It's called a lav which is inferred from an eset. There's no specific punishment for that. It's not really considered a lav. It's just basically considered. You violated an eset, but you didn't actually do a loiset. Maybe, therefore, the Pasuk also gives us Pasuk Zayin to tell us that it's a Lois Asa as well. And in fact, the Rashbam says that actually she'd get Malkus then if she married out of the Shevet. Mind you, I mean, different Achronim talk about that, maybe not necessarily, because at the time she gets married, it's not so clear that there's going to be a Savas Nachla. If she doesn't die before her husband, or if she doesn't have a son or whatever, then there's not going to be. Okay, anyway. But still, so maybe that's why Toshma, that's why Rabbi Shmuel has to bring in the third Pasuk, that's why you also have to bring in Pasuk Tes, where then the Torah repeats the Isser again. Now, you can't say the Torah.
The first one
that we quoted, which is out of order, it's the second one, the second Pasuk in the Torah, is the Isser. The second Pasuk that we quoted, which is the first one in the Torah, is the Lois Isser. And then the Torah repeats the Lois Isser. That's the question. L'chura, even if you're going to say that it had the first two psukim, or to teach us that there's an essay and a lois essay involved, the third one must be coming to teach us something new. That not only is there the problem of Asavas HaBein, that there's that his son is from another Shevet and he's going to inherit the property, but on top of that, there's also the problem of Asavas HaBaal, new, meaning, in other words, therefore, that the husband Yarshin, because if not, then there's nothing to worry about that.
What is it teaching?
So that's the point. That's what that third pasuk would be teaching us.
That what?
That you have not only Asavas HaBein, but you have Asavas HaBaal. If you have Asavas HaBaal, it means the husband inherits her. If the husband didn't inherit her, there wouldn't be Asavas HaBaal. There'd be no need for a third party.
Asavas HaBaal, is it Lois Esser or is it
Esser? No, we're saying that Asavas HaBaal is a fact. There will be Asavas HaBaal if she marries a man from another Shevet and she dies and her husband yashins her. But if there was no such thing as the husband yashining his wife, there wouldn't be an issue anyway.
Oh.
That's the point. Yeah. Okay. V'chitei, most of you might answer, still, okay, maybe lava all of the shnei lavan v'aseh. Fine, you could still answer that maybe the Torah just wants to tell us that in that case, if a woman like that were to marry out of her shevet, she'd be over on two lois essehs and an esseh. Usually we don't like to do that. Usually, as Tosfos points out, the Gemara would rather want to say that we learned something new from the pasuk rather than just say that there were extra lavan involved over here. However, the Ritva and some other Rishonim point out over here, it's a real chiddush to say that a husband who's not even related by blood to his wife should yarshin her. Therefore, the Gemara feels that maybe still you could argue that maybe the Torah doesn't want to tell us that chiddush, that it just wants to tell us extra lavim. So maybe still you only have Asavas HaBein, the husband taka doesn't yarshin from his wife, but if a woman marries a man from another shevet and they wind up having a son who yarshins from her, then it comes out she was over on two loisas as in an esser by marrying out of her shevet
instead of
saying that the husband yarshins. Yeah. So far we can't prove anything for sure. That is why Toshma, so now we bring in the fourth pasuk, Ve'elozer ben Aaron mes, the pasuk that says that Elozer passed away and he was buried in the hill of Pinchas, which we said means that Pinchas yarshined from his wife. So therefore, there we have that. How does Pinchas come to have a hill to the yarshin from his wife? Even if you're going to argue that the previous three psukim, all from Parshas Matis over here from the Torah, don't necessarily prove that a husband yarshins his wife, but from the pasuk in Pinchas, from the pasuk regarding Pinchas, you can prove that it does. Then how else would he have had this hill? The Chi Tema, you still might answer, no, not necessarily does that prove that Pinchas inherited it from his wife. Elazar who did not have so made to be Yosef Pinchas. Maybe if I care, maybe you go back one generation. Maybe it's Elazar had married a woman from Shevet Ephraim, let's say, which actually we learned before, right? We said Elazar married a woman from Benois Putiel, and we said Benois Putiel, and she's descended from Yisrael and from Yosef. So very well, she could have been on her father's side from Shevet Yosef, and she's inheriting territory in the land of Ephraim. Umesa, and then she dies, with Yosef Pinchas, and Pinchas inherits from her. In other words, you're assuming that what it is Pinchas's wife, that it was Pinchas's wife's property that she inherited from her father or her mother or whatever, and then Pinchas yarshin it from her. Why not? Maybe this was Pinchas's mother's property. Maybe it was Elazar's wife. So Elazar passed away. Shortly after that, his wife passed away too. So Pinchas yarshins her, or not even shortly after. It could be that we don't know. It doesn't even have to be at the same time. If we don't know yet that the husband yarshins from his wife, it could be she had passed away years earlier. Pinchas inherited from her because it goes to the son, not for the father, not for the husband. We don't know yet that the husband yarshins. That's what we're trying to prove over here. So maybe that's all it is. Elazar's wife had passed away years earlier. Pinchas yarshins it from her because it doesn't go to Elazar, it goes to Pinchas. Now, when Elazar passes away, it's already give us Pinchas today. So you still don't have any proof that Pinchas yarshins it from his wife. Toshma, that's why we bring in the fifth pasuk of Sgub Hoyledus Yair. That's why we bring in the fifth pasuk that Sgub fathered Yair, and Yair had these 23 cities in Eretz Yisrael. You might answer, so what? Fine, same thing. It doesn't mean that it was Yair's wife's property. Maybe it means it was Zguv's wife's property and Yair inherited it from her. The answer is no. Because if that's the case, why would the Pesukim have to repeat this concept twice? The Pesukim are not just there to tell us stories. They must be teaching us something. So it must be that at least one of those Pesukim teaches us fine. Even if you want to argue in one case, it was they yarshin it from their mother, but at least the other case has to be that they yarshin it from their wife. Yeah. Okay. So that's why Rabbi Shmuel needed five Pesukim to prove this point.
So one was to say that we
started by saying maybe the first one we're assuming means Hasavas Abeh. But if you want to argue with me, if you Hasavas Abal, that the husband inherits. If you want to argue it doesn't, it means Hasavas Abein, then I'll bring in the second passage. You're going to say that just teaches us there's a lois essay, not just an essay. I'll bring you in the third passage. You're going to say maybe the third passage just means there's two lavim and an essay. You have the story with Pinchas. You're going to argue, but maybe Pinchas inherited it from his mother. You bring in the passage about Yair and Segul. And you can't say that it means also that Yair inherited it from his mother, because then the Torah would have no, the passage of Sukkim, one in Nevi'im, one in Ksuvim, would have no reason to repeat twice that a person yashins from his mother. Okay. However, Omalei Rapapa Labaya, however, Rapapa asked Abaya, Mimai, still, how do you know that that's what the Pesukim means? How do you know that you're arguing about the last two Pesukim, the one about Pinchas and Elazar, and the one about Yair and Segub, you're arguing that it means that at least one of them has to mean that Yashin is from his wife, because otherwise it would be repetitious? Why? Dilma Lo'olam Emelach Baal Lo Yoris, maybe I'll tell you that actually a husband does not Yashin from his wife. The first three psukim from Parshas Masay, are all from Chumash Bamidbar, are all talking about the problem that the son is going to inherit from his mother, and the son belongs to a different shape from his mother. Kiddushaninan, as we answered before. You're going to ask, what about Yair and Pinchas? You can answer very simple. But Yair does love this one. You could say, Yair didn't inherit this property, not from his father, not from his wife, not from his mother, not from anybody. He bought it. Pinchas Nami Dizavan Bizban, and Pinchas also you could say that the Pasuk is telling us that he bought it. Now why would that be? The Pasuk wants to inform us that both of them were rich.
What's the chiddush?
You want to be informed that they were both great tzaddikim, they're able to get Perisayim Ba'olam Hazeh V'Akeren Kayemes La'olam Haba, and therefore the Torah wants to inform us that they were rich, and therefore that they had enough money to buy property like that. Who says that it means that either of them yashined it? So Abaye answers him that Pinchas dezoven mizban lemotis amrit. In the case of Pinchas, you can't say that he bought it. Dim came, because what would happen if he buys it? Nimtis sodach hazeres v'yovel. What's going to happen? Comes the next yovel. It's going to return to the original owner. V'nimtis sadik kovar b'kever shein shaloi. And
if he bought it, it would have returned.
If Pinchas bought the property from somebody else, and therefore temporarily it became give us Pinchas, but it's only temporarily. Next yovel, it's returning to the original owner. Now it comes out that the tzaddik Elazar is buried in a grave that's not his. So Mela, if it belongs to Pinchas, even if it never belonged to Elazar, the Urzarua, some other Rishonim say, fine, big deal. It's not such a gnai for a person to be buried in property that belongs to his son, even if it never belonged to him. Fine. That we could accept. But if you're going to say that it wasn't, that Klal was not in the family, And that Pinchas bought it, and now next Yovel, so for the rest, from then to Yemos HaMashiach, the Lazar is lying there in property that doesn't belong to him. It's a gnash. And as a matter of fact, actually, in Shulchan Aruch, it talks about the idea that we talked last week or 2 weeks ago when we had the whole sugya about Kvarim, about when we are and aren't allowed to move Kvarim. One of the rules is if a person is buried in property that doesn't belong to him, or he's not buried with his family or whatever, you're allowed to move him. You're allowed to move him to be buried together with his family. So in this case, it would be.
When did we learn that?
We talked about at the end of the seventh parak, when we talked about the whole din about you find ancient graves over there, when you're allowed to move them, when you're not allowed to move them.
That's what we
mentioned it in that connection. Yeah, briefly. The Gemara didn't really get into it, but we talked about it briefly. But yeah. So over here, we can't assume that Elazar was buried in ground that Bechlal is not in the family. That wouldn't be right. So we have to assume that Pinchas actually owned the property. New, how does he own the property? You can't just do it by buying. You have to do it by by yashining somehow. By the way, actually, a couple of the acharonim asked an interesting question. Why don't we say that Pinchas bought it from Elazar? Eliezer himself maybe sold the land to Pinchas, and therefore doesn't return to Eliezer and Yovel because it's still in the family. The answer they give is a very interesting one. We know that a person is not supposed to sell his property in Eretz Yisrael unless he's in desperate straits. So therefore, if you're going to say that that's what the pasuk is talking about,
even to
another year. So that's in Parshas Behar, this week's parsha actually, when it talks about the dinim of selling land with the
pasuk. Land, not
we're talking about land. Land is real estate.
No, if you own a condo.
No, we're talking about land. Land houses, whatever. But we learn from the pesukim over there that in this week's parsha actually that only only if he's poor, Rashi says it over there, that a person is poor and he sells from his ancestral estate. From this we learn, Rashi says that a person should only be selling his field, only if he's desperately poor. So if you were to say that, it means that the pasuk is telling us the laws of sold the field to Pinchas. Very nice. On the one hand, it tells us Pinchas is rich. On the other hand, it tells us the laws of was poor. That wouldn't be right either. So therefore, it can't mean that. It would have to mean that Pinchas bought it from somebody else. If he bought it from somebody else, it's returning to that person in Yovel. You could say, but even Matana, according to some opinions, returns in Yovel as well. So that still wouldn't work. Okay, even father's son. Okay, maybe not. But okay.
I mean, also he was rich at some times and poor at some other times.
Yeah, but you don't want to assume. You don't want to assume that. If the point is that the pasuk would be telling us that Pinchas bought it to tell us that he's rich, then you don't want to. You don't want to at the same time be implying that Allah is poor. Okay. Okay. So by Pinchas, you can't say that. Okay, by Yair, maybe, and by Yair also, by the way, the Mefarshim say that the fact that the Pasuk is making a big deal that he owned these 23 cities, you're not going to say that he owned them temporarily only until Yair, but Rashtus, it means he owned them permanently. Okay.
Third question.
So the question is, so that's what Abaya is telling, that's Abaya is telling the Papa. You're saying that maybe Yair and Pinchas bought their respective places, but at least in the case of Pinchas, you can't say that because then it comes out, Eliezer is buried in property that doesn't belong to him. Okay, Ella Ema de Nachlo Lemisdei Haramim. However, where Papa says, still, maybe you could say there's another way in which Pinchas could get land that he didn't yarshin. It could have come as a Sdei Haramim, which there's two possibilities. One is, so you have a Chayrim is a type of Hekdish. There's two types of Chayrim, actually. One is called Chayrim LaGavoya and one is called Chayrim LaKayim. Macholikus in a number of places in the Gemara, which one is the default, if you just say Hareza Chayrim. Anyway, that's not Negeya. The point is, there is such a thing as Chayrim Lakayanim, in which case it's given to the Kayanim of the current Mishmar.
What's Chayrim Lakayanim?
That's what it means. You're declaring it Chayrim, you're declaring it like devoted to Hekdish, but it goes straight to the Kayanim, as opposed to regular Hekdish would go to Berek Abayim.
No.
So in this case, so very well, you could have somebody declared their field Chayrim, and it went to the Kayanim, who were on the Mishmar of that week, and it so happened, Pinchas was one of them. So he could have gotten it that way. There's also the other so that's another thing. The Rashbam says another possibility would be with the case of Sdei Ahoza that we've talked about a number of times, where a person dedicated his field regular hektish bedek abayas or whatever. They are supposed to if they sell it to somebody else, then it goes to the Kohenim in Yovel.
Right.
Pinchas the Kohen.
So
the problem with that is that Ramban says that doesn't work chronologically, because the first Yovel after the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael was over 100 years after Matan Torah. You had that they were 40 years in the desert, 14 years conquering and dividing Eretz Yisrael. Only then did they start counting Shmittas and Yovelus. It takes 50 years till the first Yovel. So the first Yovel was 103, 104 years after Matan Torah. Eliezer had long since passed away by then.
Not necessarily,
because from the Pesukim over there in Yeshua is Mashma that Eliezer passed away not long after Yeshua. So Yeshua himself led the Jewish people into Eretz Yisrael, and then he lived 28 years after that. So he passed away, 40? He passed away 68 years after Matan Torah. Eliezer of Apashtos, not long after that. So you're talking maybe 70, 75 years after Matan Torah. You still have 30 or so years until the next year. So, okay, the Chassam Sofer comes up with an elaborate scenario how it's still possible that that could have been sold to Pinchas and then winds up going to him as a Sdei Ahoza. But okay, it's a dosh to say that. But nevertheless, it may be a doichik, but still, it's a real possibility. So you're trying to prove that how does Pinchas have a hill unless that didn't belong to his father, unless he yarshin it from his wife? But maybe he got it at Sdei Charamim, or Sdei Afoda, as the case may be. Again, where somebody declared the field cherem, and it goes to the Kohenim. Or, as the Rashbam is saying, where somebody declared it regular hektish, and it winds up going to the Kohenim and Yovel. So you don't have any proof one way or the other from that. And okay, so fine. As far as Yor, fine. You don't have. Still, you could argue that maybe Yor bought it. So you still don't have any solid proof one way or the other. Okay.
Yair,
we said Yair, the son of Segur, knew that he had the 23 cities in Eretz Yehuda. No, it doesn't say anything about Yair, but. No, because the question was, your papa is asking maybe Yair bought his property. So Rabbi is telling him there's no way to say that Pinchas bought his property. He left it open. Maybe he had Yair bought his property. So maybe the Torah wants to tell us about Pinchas that he received it as a Sdei Charamim. With Yair, the Torah wants to tell us that he was rich and prosperous and whatever, and he was able to buy this number of cities in Eretz Gilad. And that's that. You don't have any proof that either of them yarshin it from their wives.
Okay. You can ask the question, why is the Torah mentioning that?
Okay, because the Torah wants to tell us that Yair was a tzaddik, and he was zeicha l'shnei olam, he was zeicha l'shnei shulchanot, he was zeicha l'shnei hazer. And I mentioned, by the way, there was one of the shoftim named Yair also, who said the pasuk says in the pasuk tells us in Sefer Shoftim that this Yair, the shofet, also owned many cities in Eretz Gilad, 3 of them, I think, or something, and they called them Chavis Yair. So Mepharshim say it was sort of a play on words, because the earlier Yair had all those villages that are described at the end of Parshas Matos, and he called them Chavis Yair. So the later one, when he also had a large territory over there, people nicknamed it Chavis Yair in the same way. Yeah. Okay. All right. Now we come to a discussion which there's two. There's
conclusion.
So now we come to a discussion which, according to the Rashbam's understanding, this next discussion is not directly tied to the previous one. Fine, it's true. We don't really have a proof from the story with Yair or the story with Pinchas or whatever that a person yarshins from his wife. But now Abaye is going to take up a new point. Of course, not really a new point, but a related point. Going actually back to something that we discussed yesterday about the case where a woman yarshins from two different shvatim because her father is from one shevet and her mother is from another shevet. According to the Rashbam, we're starting a new topic about that. Not really a new topic, but whatever. We're abandoning the previous topic and starting a new one. We'll talk first about how the Rashbam learns it, and then we'll go back and see how Tosfos learns it, because Tosfos has a number of problems with the Rashbam's understanding. So to start with the Rashbam. Omar Abaya, after all, if you have a woman who her father was from one shevet and her mother is from another, how come it's Akra Nachla mishivta de'ima l'shivta de'aba? Don't you have a problem that the Nachla is being taken away from the shevet of her mother and going to the shevet of her father? Meaning, in other words, what do we say? In other words, according to the Rashbam, Abaya is asking a question, rather. Not so much a statement, but a question. He's asking like this. In a case that we're talking about, we said before on Kupyud Aleph Amud Aleph that when the Torah says that a woman inherits the Chobasi or Reshes Nachla, mi matois b'nei Yisrael. We said the word matois implies that she herself yarshin from two different Shvatim. Namely, we're talking about a case where a woman's father was from Shevet Reuben, let's say, and her mother is from Shevet Shimon, and they both die, and she yarshin from both of them. So now she has a Nachla from Shevet Reuben and from Shevet Shimon. The Torah is telling us that we don't want her to marry out of her shevet. The question Abaya is asking, according to the Rashbam, is the Torah only concerned about what happens with the Nachla that she receives from her father, from Shevet Reuben? So therefore, we want her to marry a man from Shevet Reuben so that Nachla doesn't pass out of the shevet.
But here it's
But that's the question. Or is the Torah also concerned about that the Nachla of Shimon shouldn't pass out of the shevet Shimon?
In other words, the father and the mother.
The father and the mother. So does the Torah want us to try and fix up that situation, to try and make it that
obviously it was both because it says matos?
That's what the discussion is going to be. But we also have to figure out how is it, after all, what is the Torah saying that she has to do? She has to marry a man from her father's shevet.
Right.
Her father's shevet is Reuben. Yeah. How does that help with the Shimon situation?
Mother's shevet.
With the mother's shevet, exactly. Yeah. So that's Abaya is asking. Mm-hmm. So after all, You have, on the face of it, you have a nachla that's being removed from the shevet of the mother, Shimon, to the shevet of the father, Reuben. Is the Torah concerned about that? Or maybe the Torah is only concerned about the nachla she inherited from Reuben. The nachla from Shimon, fine. The Torah doesn't care about whether it goes to another shevet or not. As long as she marries a man from shevet Reuben, then we're good. Or maybe not. Maybe the Torah somehow wants, and we're going to establish in a few lines what Abaya is thinking, what she should do, in order to make sure that neither Reuben nor Shimon's nachla gets taken away from her. That's the question. So the question is, so the question comes back, Umimai, who says, why do you have any reason to think that there was a problem? The Dilma, Shiny Hossam, Shukva Husva. Maybe after all, in that case, Shiny Hossam, maybe it's different in that case.
Which case?
In this case, where she yashin from two different Shvatim, Shukva Husva. That Nachla has already been removed to another Shevet. The fact of the matter is, this woman, this heiress over here, whose father is from Reuben and her mother is from Shimon, the fact of the matter is, she herself follows her father's Shevet. So automatically, even if she never gets married, even if this daughter never gets married, the Nachla has already been removed from Shevet Shimon because she herself belongs to Shevet Reuben. The point is that that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the situation that her father. According to the halacha that the husband yarshins from his wife, then it would have to be the other way around. The father passed away first, then the mother passed away, because otherwise, if the mother passed away first, the father yarshins her. But the point is, either way, right? So actually, I mean, the Rashbam puts it in terms of as soon as the daughter yarshins it, then already it's gone to Shevet Reuben. Because in other words, the point is, fine, even if we haven't established yet whether the husband yarshins from his wife, there's no question the daughter yarshins from her mother. So there's no question, at least as soon as that nachla comes to her
from her mother,
then it's already gone from Shevet Shimon to Shevet Reuben. So therefore, the question is that maybe Shekvar Husva, it's already been removed. Maybe therefore the Torah does not matter. It's a done deal.
Passes away, but who says that when the father passes away, that's not the case?
No. In other words, if we assume that we don't know yet whether the husband yarshins from his wife, fine. It is the halacha that he does. But let's say based on the previous discussion, we don't know that yet. But at any rate, fine. If nothing else, there's going to be Hastava Sabein. That we said before, there's if nothing else going to be when the father passes away and later on the mother passed away or whichever order actually according to that, whatever, when the daughter yarshins from the mother, it's going to have gone from Shevet Shimon, which is the Shevet the mother belongs to Shevet Reuben, which is the daughter.
The daughter belongs to her husband.
The daughter belongs to her father's Shevet. So what are you Abaya asking about the question, is the Torah makbid on what happens to the Nachla from Shevet Shimon? It's already a done deal anyway. There's no undoing it anyhow. We have in the Gemara Omale, but actually the Rashbam, in his understanding of the Gemara, changes the word Omale to Dilma. Maybe. The Omale actually belongs to Tosfos' Girsa in the Gemara. We'll see soon. Tosfos has a different Girsa and a different understanding in the Gemara. But so not Omale, but Dilma. So Abaya answers that, yes, but my concern is Dilma Shekvar Husva lo yamrina. Maybe we don't say this Shekvar Husva. Yes, it may be true, fine, that Nachla went already from Shimon as soon as the mother passed away, or father, as the case may be, fine. Nevertheless, maybe we don't say Shekvar Husva. Nevertheless, maybe the Torah is still not, but you don't want it to go more away from Shevet Shimon than it's already been. Maybe still the Torah wants, okay, it's true, the daughter belongs to Shevet Reuben. Nevertheless, the Torah doesn't want that now she's going to go marry a man from some other Shevet, from a third Shevet, let's say Shevet Zvulun or whatever, and it's going to completely go away from Shevet Shimon and never come back. Maybe the Torah somehow wants to ensure that the mother's side also is somehow going to stay by somebody who has a relationship to Shevet Shimon. Okay. But now, so Omalei Rav Yemer L'Ravashi. So Rav Yemer asked Ravashi, I don't understand what Abaya is asking. If you're going to say that this Shekvar Husva is a valid way of looking at it, that once it was moved, that it's already been moved, it's a done deal, therefore the Torah is not marked on it. Then we can understand that the pasuk is, as Rabbi Shmuel was saying before, the pasuk is telling us that there's two potential problems. If she were to marry, if this daughter were to marry outside her shevet, outside her father's shevet, that is. Number one, when it comes to her father's property from shevet Reuben, number one, you have the potential problem of a seves haben, that is the hasavas haben, that's going to go to her son, who's from shevet Zvolun or whatever, let's say. And number two, that her own husband, who's also from shevet Zvolun, is going to, one or the other, is going to end up inheriting it, and either way, what she inherited from her father, from shevet Reuben, is going to pass out of that shevet. So if you're going to say that we ignore the question of what happened to the stuff from Shevet Shimon, because it's already a done deal, then fine. The Torah is telling us she should make sure to marry from Shevet Reuben. That at least will salvage the Reuben situation. The Shimon situation can't be salvaged. It's a done deal already. There's no way for her to marry somebody who belongs both to Reuben and Shimon on the face of it.
But there's no guarantee.
At least until we see that maybe there is. But for purposes of the argument, so if you say the Torah is saying never mind the what happened to the mothers because it's already a done deal, then fine. The Torah is telling us make sure she marries somebody from Shevet Reuben, and that way at least what she inherited from her father stays in Shevet Reuben.
But if she doesn't,
if she does, that's what the Torah is saying. She has to. Again, we're
going
to learn.
She's not going to get married because it's not a Shevet.
She has to marry somebody from her shevet. That's what we said before. That it was said before early on the Amud. If she was over on that, she'd be over on possibly as many as two loitzes as in an ephah. And we're going to learn later on in the Perek that this whole concept only applied in the first generation after they came into Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, after that they darshan the pasuk and understood that this din only applies in that generation. That's why it's not counted among the 613 mitzvahs.
Just counted.
Well, we'll see when we'll get to it next week.
The second generation
isn't apply. Second generation didn't apply anymore yet. The Torah was only marked at the beginning. We'll see. We'll talk about there. That's one of the reasons why Tuba Av is a yomtiv, because that's the
it
day.
It has to be mitzalfim.
Now, what do you mean it has to be mitzalfim? It's from Karka.
Why didn't we say just the land stays in Shevet, period?
If a woman from Shevet Reuben marries a man from Shevet Shimon, or the other way around, and her husband yarshins her, or her son yarshins her, it goes, the husband or the son belongs to Shevet Shimon. It goes to that Shevet. That's not Avas Nacha. That's what we're talking about. That's the definition of how your Yerusha works. Okay. Anyway. So, if you're going to say that Shekvar Husva is a reasonable thing, that in other words, the Torah say, never mind what happened, what she yarshined from her mother, from Shevet Shimon, there's no undoing that anyway, then fine. The Torah is telling her, marry somebody from Shevet Reuben, at least this way, what you inherited from your father will remain within Shevet Reuben. But if you're going to say, like Abaye is asking, that we don't accept the Shekhar Husva argument, that we say that since she inherited from Reuben and from Shimon, the Torah is out to ensure that the Nachla from Reuben is going to stay in Reuben and the Nachla of Shimon is going to stay in Shimon, well, my Hava. So how does it help if she marries somebody from her father's Shevet Reuben? Hamas Akra Nachla Meshivta De'ima Leshivta De'aba. Wouldn't the Nachla from Shevet Shimon anyway end up going to Shevet Reuben? So why is Abaye even asking? That's what the Rashbam explains, the point of the question. If we say we don't accept Shekhar Husva, we say the Torah wants that this girl who inherited from Shevet Reuben from her father and Shevet Shimon from her mother, and the Torah wants that both what she inherited from Shevet Reuben should stay in Shevet Reuben and what she inherited from Shevet Shimon should stay in Shevet Shimon, how is the Torah solving that by saying that she needs to marry within her father's shevet? Then Reuben is taken care of, Shimon is not taken care of. Obviously, you must say, therefore, that the Torah does not care about hasavat ta'im. The Torah is not concerned about what happens to the property from the mother from Shevet Shimon, and that would answer Abaye's question.
So why is he asking,
in other words, yeah. The answer is because Abaye would answer, maybe Abaye would say that maybe what the Torah is going to be masked on is you want to make sure that this girl is going to marry a man who's in the same situation as her, whose father is from Shevet Reuben and whose mother is from Shevet Shimon. Now, yes, when it comes to a Shevet Abayin, it's true when they have a son, that son is going to belong to Shevet, that son is going to belong to Shevet Reuben, and there's no getting around that. But at least this way, at the time she gets married, you're not creating any more hasava than there was before. Before, if she had never gotten married, the property would be going to somebody who is half Reuben, half Shimon, namely herself. Like this is also going to somebody, if she passes away without having any children, then it goes to her husband who's half Reuben, half Shimon. Maybe that's what the Torah wants. And a buyer could answer. But a buyer could say maybe that's a buyer's question. Is the Torah insisting on that or not? Or is the Torah saying, I'm not worried about what happened to the Nachla she got from her mother, from Shevet Shimon. I'm only concerned about the Nachla she got from her father, from Shevet Reuben. And therefore, marry somebody from Shevet Reuben, and I don't care what Shevet his mother came from. Okay, so the question is, if a buyer is going to understand that the Torah might be requiring that.
That's going to be the question now.
A buyer would say that, no, even though the Torah uses the expression, that's the thing. The Torah uses the expression, again, we're talking about a woman who inherits from two matas, from Reuben and Shimon. What is the pasuk saying? She has to marry a man from the shevet of her father. So that's what. Now, Abaya, the Gemara is saying, Rabashi is telling Rabbi Yemer that Abaya would have to understand, that was the nub of Abaya's question, is the Torah actually saying that her husband has to be from Shevet Reuben, and I don't care what Shevet his mother is from, or is the Torah saying that his father has to be from Reuben and his mother has to be from Shimon, just like she herself? That's the question. If you're going to understand it like that, in that case, the Torah should spell it out that he has to be somebody who belongs to both Shvatim. The answer is, yes, but Abaya might answer that no, the Torah didn't say it like that, because if the Torah said that she has to marry a man who is from the Shevet of her father and her mother, then you would think it could be just as well the other way around. It could be that her husband's father is from Shevet Shimon, meaning he belongs to Shevet Shimon, and his mother is from Shevet Reuben, the opposite of her. As long as you have both Shevatim involved, maybe that would be good enough. Kamash Malon, and that would be why the Torah only uses the word Mishpachas Matei Aviyah to imply, as far as affiliation to a Shevet, he has to be affiliated with Shevet Reuben. In other words, his father has to be from Shevet Reuben. But the implication is also, because she herself inherited from Shimon as well, then his mother has to be from Shimon as well, in order that he's like her. Or maybe not. That's a biased question. And according to that explanation of it, the Gemara is leaving the question open. Abaya has his question, and we don't know the answer. In that case, is the Torah makbid on Sibas Aim, is the Torah makbid on Hasavat Nachos Aim or not?
Because we don't know.
Because the Torah couldn't have said that she has to marry a man who's from both Shvatim, because then we would misunderstand and say, as long as one of his parents is from Reuben and one is from Shimon, it's good enough. Doesn't matter which one is which. By saying that she has to be from Matei Aviha implies, as far as affiliation to a Shevet, it has to be Matei Aviha. But we are meant to understand by ourselves that he also has to have a mother from Shevet Shimon, otherwise you have the problem of a Savas Nachlatein. Or maybe not. That's what Abaya's question is. Now, that's all according to the Rashbam. There are some Rishonim who explain, based on a bit of a different girsa, that Abaya's question is not so much that, it's more the question, Bechlau, what does the Torah expect that you should do as far as the Nachla of the mother? Not like Rashbam is saying that he's asking, is the Torah concerned about it or not? According to this other explanation, which are a couple of the Rishonim, the Ritva and some others say, the question is, if we assume as a given that the Torah is concerned what happens to Nachla's name, how do we fix up the situation? And so the Gemara goes back and forth on it until Rav Ashi answers. The answer is that she would have to marry a man whose father is from her father's Shevet and whose mother is from her mother's Shevet. In other words, according to that way of looking at it, the premise of the question is a little bit different, and the answer is not what Abaya was thinking all this time. It was a question which Abaya Taka didn't know the answer to until eventually Rav Ashi comes up with the answer. Now, Tosfos has a whole different way of understanding the Mahalach of the Gemara. Because among other things, Tosfos doesn't accept the change of girsa that the Rashbam does. But besides that, they say, it's very odd. The Gemara sort of left the previous discussion hanging. We said that Rav Papa said you can't prove from the psukim involving Pinchas and Yer anything about yarshining from about a husband yarshining from his wife. All of a sudden, Abaya is coming in with a question, which the wording of his question, sounds like the girsa that Tosfos has is iam b'shleima shkavus. Tosfos has the girsa that Abaya starts by asking her papa, if you're going to say a husband doesn't yarshin, then what about my question? That sounds like he's continuing the argument. Doesn't sound like he's starting a whole new topic, like the Rashbam says. So therefore, because of that, and because of a couple of other reasons, Tosfos explains that the discussion goes like this. Abaya starts by saying, you're arguing, Rav Papa, that the psukim don't prove anything about a husband yarshining. So the first three psukim you could argue are all talking about a son yarshining, and it establishes that there's two lavim and an essay involved. The last two psukim maybe are talking about the Pinchas and Yoreh bought their respective properties, the Pinchas received it as a stecherem. Okay, all very nice. But the fact of the matter is, Abaya says, if you're going to say that a husband doesn't yarshin, if you're going to say a husband yarshins, and therefore at least one of those psukim teaches us that a husband yarshins, and the Torah is concerned about that you don't want him to be from another shevet, and then it's going to go out of the property of the original shevet, then we understand. Therefore, the pasuk tells us like this: the yerusha of the mother, on one level, it's already a done deal; it can't really be undone. But nevertheless, we can argue, the Torah wants to at least prevent it, the Torah wants at least to make it that when the daughter gets married, that it shouldn't become even worse. So what do we do? That it shouldn't become more of a hasava than it was already. So how do we do that? As Gemara says in a few lines, you make sure that her husband, his father is from the same shevet as her father, the mother is from the same shevet as her mother, and therefore at least we've accomplished by her marrying that. Okay, but nevertheless, at least by doing that, we've accomplished that when she gets married, there's no more hasava than there was before. So if you're going to say that the Torah is that there is such a thing as a husband yarshining from his wife, then we understand what the Torah is trying to accomplish by telling her to marry within her shape.
The father is from
the mother. That's what we're going to get to later. But so it is true, at least, at a later stage, the husband's going to pass away, the son is going to inherit, he's going to be from another shevet. Fine, that can't be helped. Ultimately, ultimately a person belongs only to one shevet. But if you're going to say, Abaya is continuing the argument, again, according to Tosfos, this is the continuation of the previous discussion. If you, the papa, are going to tell me you have no proof that a husband yarshins from his wife, then the only concern is that the Yerusha is going to go to a son from a different shevet. If she marries somebody from whose father is from the same shevet as hers and the mother is from the same shevet as hers, you still have hasavas nachla. You still have that the son ultimately belongs to only one shevet and the nachla has been moved from one shevet to another. So, and that's the point. In other words, Abaya is saying, according to this explanation, if you say that the husband yarshins from his wife, there is at least a way to make sure that the husband marrying his wife doesn't cause more of a hasavas nachla than there was already. His father is from the same shevet as her father, his mother is from the same shevet as her mother, and therefore fine. But if you're going to tell me that there's no such thing as a husband yarshining from his wife, and there's only a son yarshining from his mother, automatically there's hasavas nachla anyway. And the Torah doesn't seem to be concerned about that.
If you're going to say that
the husband doesn't yarshin, so shouldn't that itself prove that the husband yarshins from his wife? So then Rav Papa comes and says to Abaya, why? Maybe indeed, yes. The nachal se'em, it's already a done deal. There is nothing that can be done about it. Shekvar husva, it was already moved over from one shevet to another. So the Torah Taka is not concerned about who she marries. Her husband's Taka not yarshining, her son's yarshining. There's nothing that can be done in that case about Yerusha Se'em anyway, because inevitably it's going to another shevet. Therefore, the Torah is not concerned about it. And Abaya answers him back. According to that, we do have Omale, that's Abaya answering Rav Papa and saying, no, there's no reason to think that the Torah shouldn't be mastered. What happens to what she yarshined from her mother? The fact of the matter is, if the Torah wasn't concerned about it, it would have no reason to talk about the case where she's inheriting mimat tois from two shvatim. The Torah could have just said very simple, she inherits from one shevet. She inherits from one shevet. The fact that the Torah is mentioning the fact that she inherits from two shvatim sounds like the Torah wants to be concerned what happens to the nachla from both shvatim, which implies that her husband yarshins her, and with her husband, there's a possibility of him being in the same status as her, being from two shvatim, just as she is. So then Rav Yehuda comes in and asks that after all, okay, she's going to get married to somebody from her father's shevet, then the nachla se'em is going to be moved to her father's shevet anyway. And the answer is that you have to understand, you have to realize that Abaya was understanding that the Pasuk would want her to marry again a man whose father is from the same Shevet as her and her mother is, and his mother is from the same Shevet as her. Therefore, Abaya is thinking, not like the Rashbam's explanation that Abaya is wondering, does the Torah require that or not? According to this explanation of Tosfos, Abaya would be stating a fact. The Torah does want you to do that because that way, at least when she gets married, there's no Hatzavas Nachla. That's not making the situation any worse than it was
by giving it to
another shevet. So eventually it will go to another shevet when they pass away and their son inherits, but that can't be helped. At least the Torah wants you to do what you're able to do. Okay, so according to either one of those explanations, then it comes out that Abaya is either asking should it be that way, or saying that the Torah Taka wants it that way. But and then again, according to the
Dilma.
So it's either a Dilma or Amale that he said to him that the Torah, we don't say Shikra Hosva, right? Yes. Okay.
The din is.
Well, the din is. I mean, it's not really relevant to halacha anyway, because this whole concept only applied in the first dur. No, never mind today. It only applied in the first dur when they came into Eretz Yisrael anyway. There is actually one thing that does come out of this, which is, if we say there's such a thing as Hasavas Abal, if we say the Torah is concerned about Hasavas Abal, then which is what Abaya is trying to say, then it means that the husband yarshining his wife is actually a din d'oraisa. As opposed to, if not, then it means that the husband yarshining his wife is only midrabana. Now, the Rambam actually says that a husband yarshining his wife is midivrei sofrim. So what does that mean? Some of the Noseh Kelim on the Rambam say that it means that he doesn't understand the Gemara the way Tosfos does. He would have to understand it more like Rashbam does, or like some of the other Mefarshim do, or whatever, and say that there's no proof in the Torah one way or the other. The husband yarshins his wife. Like Rav Papa said, you can slog up the proof small of sofrim. Therefore, the whole concept is only the Rabbanan. Or some of the Noseh Kelim on the Rambam, the Kesef Mishnah, and others say no. The Rambam often uses the word divrei sofrim to mean something that's learned through the Yud Gimel Midrash Shatur and Yeshus Behem, but it doesn't say explicitly in the Pasuk, but something which is still considered Daraisa. According to which, you could still say that it is Daraisa, it's just not something that's spelled out in the Pasuk. As we said before, we have to learn it either from the combination of Sukkim, or from Gurun, or Mesif, and Vidoshin, or whatever.
So the
conclusion is that Amram says that a husband yarshining his wife is medivrei sofrim. But again, what does he mean by medivrei sofrim? Does it mean daraisa or did I bon? That's the question.